The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to this special edition on Saturday morning of the Space Show. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. It is the 10th of April, and we're talking today about show number 1341. For those of you who would like to call us, please write down our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring until I can answer it, and I'll bring you up on air just as soon as possible. Email is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, or you can use dmlivings@yahoo.com. And chat is on IMICQ or CompuServe. The screen name is the same, one word, lowercase, space, show, chat. It is visible and working right now. If for some reason you don't see it, ping me anyway at spaceshowchat or send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember, we're trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download shows and distribute them to get the word out about space. However, nothing commercial with any of these programs and no changes or modifications to any of the interviews. And we do podcast with Andrew over at gigadial.net. We're iTunes compatible. Search for The Space Show or my name. We're in Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com in South America, and a host of other sites. So if you have any questions about our podcast or want to know where to pick it up or how to subscribe to it, let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our website is thespaceshow.com, so there is a comprehensive newsletter there. You can't miss it. It has all of the week's events in detail. It has the bios of our guests in detail. And it has a future events section. And this is where we make announcements and changes to the program when we need to. This is the first place you'll find them, so I would urge you to check it from time to time. If you want the very short email newsletter sent to you, it goes out early Monday morning, California time, then please send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website, or you can easily download these shows. We have a store. You'll see it on the website. It's called Space Show Gear. And, of course, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org. We could not do this program without your support. We absolutely need it. And thank all of you who do support us. Please remember also the Space Show is brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more info, visit SecureWorldFoundation.org. And for the next few days, the only hold the event I want to take time and tell you about is the very prestigious Churchill Club has a program in Palo Alto Wednesday, April 21st. It's a space commercialization panel with Dr. Peter Diamandis of XPRIZE, Naveen Jain, who's the CEO of Intellius, and he's also an investor, and Dr. Bob Richards, who is the CEO of Odyssey Moon and a co-founder of International Space University. And I am moderating this panel. There may be one or two others joining it. The Churchill Club has not yet finalized everyone who's participating. But I have been given several free tickets for people who want to go hear the panel, which is 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Palo Alto, California. Normally, these tickets would cost $75. They're free if you get them from me while my limited supply holds up. And I've already given out quite a few of them. So if you're interested, if you're in the Bay Area and you can actually make it to Palo Alto on Wednesday evening, April 21st, and you want to hear this panel on space commercialization, send me an email as soon as possible so that you can be one of the ones getting a free ticket. The Churchill Club is really cool. You ought to check it out. And their website is churchillclub.org. And you'll see this program, Space Commercialization, right there on their first page. Well, today we have a great show. I've been looking forward to it for a long time because we're going to be talking about suborbital research, which is in the news a lot lately. It's even part of what's being talked about with the administration's new space program. We have two great guests with us. Dr. Alan Stern is back on the show. He's a planetary scientist, space program executive, consultant, and author. He's associate VP of the Southwest Research Institute, and he has his own aerospace consulting firm with clients including Blue Origin, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, Odyssey Moon, Google Lunar XPRIZE Team, Boeing Aerospace, Johns Hopkins University. He also has the Pluto mission, New Horizons. He's the PI. His bio is going to be up on the website. It is way too long to keep reading because we will never get to the program. And so it's great to have Alan back on the show. And we also have with us Dr. John Poyman, Professor Poyman, and he earned his doctorate in chemical physics at the University of Texas in Austin. He worked for 2 years at Brandeis with Irving Epstein. He joined chemistry and biochemistry department at the University of Southern Mississippi, where he taught for 18 years. And then he went to LSU in August 2008, and he is a professor of macromolecular science. To shorten his lengthy bio, he is the PI for a sounding rocket experiment for the miscible fluids and microgravity investigation and the ISS, and he is also doing an experiment for Blue Origin suborbital demo flight. So he is very much involved in what we're talking about today. So Dr. Stern and Professor Poyman, welcome to the Space Show, and how are you both?
Great.
Yeah, great.
So, Alan, let's hear what you sound like so everyone will be able to tell you apart.
This is Alan speaking.
And John?
This is John Poyman.
Okay, so now, listeners, you can tell them apart. We have a huge global audience, and our domestic audience is growing by leaps and bounds, and I would suspect a lot of people aren't really familiar with suborbital research, the potential, what's happening with the suborbital research group out of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation. So, Alan, why don't you start out and do the 101 to introduce us to this topic?
Sure, happy to, David. Well, let me start at the very beginning. I think almost everybody on the show probably knows that we're on the verge of a whole new era in human spaceflight with a new generation of reusable, primarily human-carrying spacecraft to go up to altitudes of 100 kilometers to about 140 kilometers. People have heard a lot about, for example, Virgin Galactic, other companies like Armadillo Aerospace, X-Corps, Blue Origin, even Masten, that are building these vehicles as commercial ventures, much of it aimed at the tourism market. But what less people know is that there's also a very large interest on the part of researchers and educators across a whole spectrum of different fields to use these vehicles in whole new ways for their scientific or engineering research, for some kinds of operational research related to spaceflight, and also for education and public outreach.
And well, I know one of the questions that's going to come in is there are already suborbital sounding rockets for this kind of research, and academics use them all the time. So what is the difference between what you're talking about and doing your experiment on a sounding rocket? Who wants to take that?
Who should go first?
I'll let Alan take that.
Okay. Alan, that one's yours. How do you distinguish what you're talking about versus just going out and getting a sounding rocket ride?
Well, sure. There's night and day difference. And I've used sounding rockets. I've been involved in flying sounding rocket missions as far back as 1983. Been an engineer on some of those missions. I've been a scientific co-investigator and principal investigator. And then, of course, at NASA headquarters, I was responsible for that program, which is a fantastic program. In fact, we doubled the budget for it a couple years ago when I was at NASA headquarters. But what these new vehicles, the reusable vehicles, offer is a whole new set of capabilities that we've never had before. Very briefly, and I won't go into each and every detail, but let me give you, just tick off the big ticket items. First, they're going to fly at unprecedented flight rates. Currently, NASA flies a couple dozen sounding rocket missions per year. These vehicles are going to fly daily to weekly, depending upon which brand we're talking about. Some are even talking about flying multiple times a day from different sites. Secondly, they carry people. That's a huge difference. All the existing sounding rockets are unmanned. Third, they operate at about 10 cents on the dollar for flight cost. Instead of about $2.5 million that it costs NASA to fly a sounding rocket, when you include everything soup to nuts, this is more like a couple hundred thousand dollars to fly a scientist or an educator or a tourist or an experiment. So we have very high flight rates. We have the ability to bring human beings along, which can really enhance the research or the education, and very low costs. There are some other advantages. We can talk about those, too. They're more technical. And there are things that the unmanned rockets will do better. For example, they go to higher altitudes. But we're just on the verge of this era of low-cost, very frequent access to space that we've never had before.
Can you do a sounding? Can you do an experiment with say, a normal passenger on the vehicle? So let's say, for example, it's Virgin, where they have, you know, four, five, six passengers. Can you still put an experiment on that? Who tends the experiment?
Well, you certainly can. I think you're asking, David, about whether we could fly mixed flights with both tourists and researchers, for example.
Well, do you have to have a – well, I guess let me back up. Do you have to have a human researcher on board the flight to service the research?
No. Experiments can fly unmanned or they can fly with a human.
Okay.
Either way, depending upon what the experiment, you know, needs. And the experiments can be quite small, shoebox-sized things up to refrigerator-sized things. So, they can be automated, and some will go better if there's somebody there to run them. You can lower the cost if you don't have to automate, for example. Or if you're doing research on a human being, obviously you need the human being as the test subject. We can give you other examples of how the researcher actually there in the loop improves the experiment, but those are just two.
I have another question. Either of you can answer this. You just mentioned experiments on humans. So I have limited experience in this, but I know the problems that a lot of people encounter if you're doing experiments on humans, because these are commercial flights and anyone who can pay can go up. Do you still have to go through independent review and all of that stuff that you do to do research on humans if you're at a university or with the government?
Yes, that'll be the case, except with one exception. If you want to do an experiment on yourself, then I don't believe that you're required to go through any review. And I think a lot of space tourists will probably be interested in being biomedical test subjects because it makes them a part of the mission. And it may be just as simple as wearing a blood pressure monitor or some other kind of gear like shuttle astronauts wear, just so that we can enlarge the database of how various kinds of people react to the zero-gravity environment.
But then they would end up having to do independent review and go through that process with the researcher.
Well, again, I'm certainly not an expert in this, but I believe that you can volunteer yourself without going through any review. It's only when a third party, a test subject who is other than yourself, is being involved. So if an experimenter, let's say the Johnson Space Center space medicine folks, or the Federal Aviation Administration space medicine folks, or a given university wants to take data using space tourists, they will have to go through independent review. But if you, David, buy a ticket and you want to do an experiment on yourself for your own purposes, you wouldn't have to.
Cool. So, John, I know you have a project selected for Blue Origin. So I think, you know, describing that would help listeners really understand what we're talking about here. Can you give us a...
Certainly, and I'd like to, I could also add on to Alan, maybe help people understand the value of the suborbital opportunities if people are familiar with other ways you can study things in weightlessness, which is my primary interest. There's drop towers where you may get to 2 to 5 or 10 seconds when something is just falling through the evacuated chamber. Then there's the KC-135 or vomit comet, which people are familiar with when you get maybe 20 seconds of weightlessness, and that can be easily tended by an individual. And the experiment I'll describe has been done in that environment. But when we talk about going to the suborbital flights, we're giving ourselves now significantly maybe three to more minutes of weightlessness. And so we're now giving ourselves an added range of experimental opportunities. And so that's why I'm excited about it. So the particular experiment I'm studying is we're looking at what are called miscible fluids, fluids that can dissolve in each other 100%. And it's well known that when you have immiscible fluids, like, say, salad oil and water, that there's what's called an interfacial tension between the fluids. And if you heat along that interface, there'll be a fluid motion that's not caused by gravity. And this has been studied quite a bit in on the shuttle and sounding rocket experiments. We're looking at systems that can act like immiscible fluids for a period of time, and we want to observe, is it possible to see fluid motion caused by what we call an effective interfacial tension? And that's simply not possible to do on the Earth because buoyancy-driven convection caused by gravitational forces, simply overwhelms what we're attempting to observe.
So how do you do it on the suborbital flight, and how many minutes of suborbital flight time do you probably get?
We'll have a few minutes, and the key is the way we start the experiment, we start with two fluids, which are called isobutyric acid and just regular water. And when you have them below 27 degrees centigrade, they form two different phases, like oil and water. And we'll start out below 27 degrees, and then when we achieve weightlessness, then we'll raise the temperature, and now we'll have a sharp jump between the two fluids, but now they're in what's called the miscible regime. And now the fluids, over time, would eventually dissolve into each other, but we'll have a period of time in which we can provide a heatier source and heat along this gradient and observe, is there any fluid motion that's caused by this effective interfacial tension? And then we'll have a control sample to see if there's any effects just from residual, any little bit of acceleration left in the flight path.
Do you get the information you want after one experiment, one test flight, or is this something that you do over a series of flights?
Well, I think the first will be just to test our hypothesis that there should be some fluid motion observed, and that will be the sort of a proof of concept. But this could be, the ideal would be able to do this many, many times, and that's what's exciting about suborbital is it's not something we have to plan years in advance to execute once, say on the space station or the shuttle, but now the space station. This would give us the opportunity to change it and say, okay, now let's change how much we heat. Let's change how much we, what temperature we start at, to do multiple, many, many runs, and then be able to compare to computer simulations to better understand this phenomenon.
Now, I'm assuming your students work on this project, correct?
The fundamental work has been done by students, but the actual development of the experiment is done by myself with my colleague at William Jewell College, Professor Pat Bunton, who's actually building the hardware. And the actual hardware is being built by him and his undergraduate students at William Jewell College.
Undergraduate students?
Yes. Yes. So it's an exciting opportunity for them to be involved in this type of research program. Which is really, we expect to see a lot more of those opportunities through the suborbital research.
For either of you, if you start out and let's say you fly this as you're planning on Blue Origin, can you shift and fly another part of the experiment or do another flight, say, on Virgin or X-Corps or whoever else has a flight? Are you limited in these experiments to the same parameters of the same vehicle, or would switching vehicles change too much that would skew your experiment?
Well,
you want to go ahead, John?
Well, I think you know more about the other platforms. I think each it would depend on how the hardware could be integrated. I think all of them are going to fly probably fairly similar, but you know more about the particulars of other craft.
Yeah, I think that a lot of experiments will be designed in a way that they can be integrated into different vehicles. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to that. For example, the vehicles that Masten are building don't take human beings. So if you require a human being or if a human being helps your experiment outcome or lowers your cost, if you need a human being, you can't fly on a Masten vehicle because they're not planning that. If you require multiple human beings, you'll need a vehicle that can carry multiple people. And, for example, X-Corp can only carry one passenger, and they go to somewhat lower altitudes. But I think that there's going to be a lot of examples of experiments being flown many, many times and using different vehicles so they can get in the flight manifest often or to change launch sites because it may be, for example, if you're looking at atmospheric or astronomical phenomena that you want to fly from specific locations. And those vary with the different companies.
I think, David, for the type of work we're doing when we're looking at say, fluids in weightlessness, that's much more generic. It doesn't really matter on the craft as much as the conditions, the weightless environment. But many other type of suborbital science will be, that, for example, involving atmospheric research or astronomical that Alan could talk more about, may benefit from particular crafts and particular launch parameters.
Here's your first listener question. I guess this could be for either one of you. This is from Joseph, and Joseph is in San Diego. And he says, you're talking about atmospheric research. So do these experiments generally have to stay within the vehicle, especially if they're human-tended, or are these experiments outside the vehicle in space itself?
Well, that's an excellent question. There are as many different kinds of atmospheric experiments as there are atmospheric scientists, but they generally fall into the two categories that the question's really about. Some experimenters want direct access to sample the high upper atmosphere at altitudes of many tens of kilometers up to 130-140 kilometers, or to inject things in the atmosphere like tracers, which can be seen from the ground to make sort of a cloud, which you can then watch it disperse and measure the winds. That would be an example of what's called an active experiment. That, like sampling, requires something on the outside of the vehicle, either an inlet port or a port to deploy things into the atmosphere. But there are also experiments, atmospheric science experiments, that you can do from inside the cabin, where, for example, you would use remote sensing equipment, either imagers or spectrometers, or even illuminating the atmosphere, for example, with a LIDAR from inside the cabin. There'll be a lot of both categories.
I'm a little surprised at this question, but then again, maybe I'm not, because this is a space show. This is Paula, and Paula is near me in Berkeley, California. Maybe that also helps to explain it. Paula says, since people can design their own experiments, I'm really curious, if you zero out the cost and don't worry about how much my idea cost, can I design my own experiment and put my dog or cat on the vehicle and do an animal experiment? And if I was able to do that, would I need to get any permits to fly an animal in the vehicle and do an experiment on the animal in space?
Alan, that's one for you.
I was afraid John would say that.
I mean, well,
I want to break this. It's a good question.
Well, what if a veterinarian school wanted to do an animal research project like UC Davis or something, rather than an owner of a pet?
Right. Well, let's break it down in parts. First of all, if you buy a ticket, these are commercial companies.
Right.
If you buy a ticket, the commercial companies are going to make sure of just a couple of things, and then they're going to fly you. Let me list what they're going to make sure of. First, that your check doesn't bounce. Second, they're going to make sure that whatever you're flying is safe to their vehicle and any other passengers that are on board. And then third, they're going to have to make sure that there are no regulatory issues where the given activity is out of bounds. in some way. And so let me now walk through that. In the case of the listener's question, putting a dog in zero gravity might even be a safety hazard to the vehicle or to the other people on board. If the dog freaked out and started scratching and clawing in zero gravity, or if it fell on you as the G's start up, and the G's come up to about 5 or 6 G's on entry, it could hurt another passenger. So you can't just fly your dog in space, but it's probably possible to build the right enclosure to allow animal subjects or pets to fly, but that have to be well thought out and pass the safety process of the vehicle provider that you're buying the ticket from. And then whether or not you require some other layer of permissions in terms of using an animal as a test subject is beyond my expertise. I sort of vaguely suspect you do, but I don't really know.
I can comment on that, Alan, having been involved in animal research, not related to space, but there's every university, if it were from a university, requires an animal review committee, and that's just if it's coming from a university. And if it involves any federal funding, that's a federal law that it must undergo a animal use committee to make sure that it's not a redundant science and that it's done in an ethical and manner in treatment of the animal. So if it's a private individual, that would be up to the company. There wouldn't be any laws, as far as I know, but if it involved any university-based research, it would have to be reviewed internally by the university to make sure that it is a legitimate scientific investigation and done in a humane manner.
Well, I would imagine if the passengers are flying in a spacesuit in a particular vehicle and you're going to put an animal up there, you probably, I don't know if you'd be allowed to do it if they're not in a spacesuit somehow.
Well, in many of these vehicles, though, David, the passengers on board and the flight crew do not wear spacesuits.
Okay.
It's a short-sleeve cabin environment with normal atmospheric pressure, temperatures, and normal conditions. And the vehicles are built to be safe on these short flights, just like an airliner cabin. If the airliner cabin had a hole punctured in it high up in the stratosphere at 40,000 feet, it would be bad for those on board. But the vehicle is designed not to do that. These are similarly designed, and many of them are just shirt sleeve cabins.
John, if you're going to have your experiment go up and it's tended by a human, do you pay for both the experiment and you as the spaceflight participant? So you have two costs involved in doing this, or do you simply buy the ticket as the spaceflight participant and you bring your experiment along? I'm trying to get the commercial mechanism here.
Well, I could comment on this, first on the specifics of our experiment. This has been, opportunity has been generously provided by Blue Origin at no cost to ourselves and two other investigators.
Okay.
Ours is going to be an unmanned, autonomous experiment. In terms of the pricing for others, Alan has more expertise in how the commercial avenue may want to deal with that issue of people and experiments.
Sure, I'll chime in.
Or can they hire a spaceflight participant and teach them to be the tender?
All those things are possible, David. It's a commercial world. If your experiment's small, if it, for example, is small enough to fly with you in your seat, if it goes in your pocket, if you're wearing a biomedical harness, if it's as simple as that, you probably just buy a seat and there's no additional cost. But if you're flying something that's too large to fit with you safely, then you'd have to buy that additional space. And most of the providers are thinking along models where they'll charge you by the pound or by the cubic foot. But again, for very small experiments, I know that you'll just be able to do that as a part of your normal activities that you would want to do, just like a tourist might bring along a camera, for example. It's also likely that some experimenters won't want to send somebody from their own group. They may want to hire a professional payload specialist who's flown many times and has the experience and the background to make sure it's going to get done. In fact, I've had a number of scientific researchers tell me, I don't want to fly myself. I'm pretty good in the lab, but I'm not good under severe time pressure. And since there's only a few minutes to get it done and the stakes are sort of high, $200,000 for a flight, then I'd really rather see some professional astronaut do it. And so that creates a market for a new kind of astronaut, a commercial payload specialist. And I expect that there'll be quite a number of these people in coming years with a wide range of backgrounds and expertise, and many of them will fly many, many times, dozens or maybe hundreds of times, conducting experiments.
Robert in Atlanta has this email question for either of you. I guess, John, why don't you try to deal with it first? And he says, when you fly a commercial experiment on the space station, there is a peer review sort of process that you have to go through to have your project approved. If you're in a true commercial world, you pay the money and off you go. So how close is flying a suborbital experiment on one of these flights to pay your money and off you go without any peer review or approval process?
Well, I think that's exactly how it will be for the commercial world, is if you're willing to pay for it and it meets the safety requirements. I don't envision that the commercial provider will have much of an issue with what you attempt to answer on the flight.
Does Blue Origin intend to review or scrutinize, other than to make sure you're complying with safety or something like that, the quality or the purpose of the experiment, Alan?
For the demonstration experiment that John and a couple of other principal investigators are involved in, we at Blue Origin did do that simply because we wanted to make sure that we were selecting a good suite of demonstrators that had high reliability and people that we were convinced could, if you will, be at the church on time, meet the schedule, and really take advantage of our capabilities, because for us, the quid pro quo is beta testing, if you will. By actually doing real experiments with real investigators, it allows Blue to pioneer what will later be a for-profit commercial venture where we're charged. But I want to also back up, David, and say there will be peer review in many cases of suborbital experiments when government funding is involved, or even industrial funding. If an industrial firm or a government agency, whether it's National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation, NASA, Department of Defense, whatever, or it might be just a big firm that wants to do microgravity research, for example, or a pharmaceutical firm, whatever, I'm sure that they will peer review the kinds of things they pay for to make sure that they're getting the best bang for their buck. But if just a private individual wants to fly an experiment, again, the providers are only interested in, can you pay the price, and is it going to be safe to my vehicle and the others on board? There wouldn't be any peer review normally.
When do you see revenue streams, commercial flights, actually starting, say, on Blue? Are they the furthest along on this?
Well, I don't think I can judge who's furthest along because I don't know everybody's schedules. But I think if you look generally at this suite of five different suborbital firms, some could be flying revenue flights for equipment, not for people yet, but equipment, as early as next year. I think that by the year after next, it's very likely that at least one and potentially several firms will be flying experimenters, tourists, and equipment, and that's just in 2012, 2 years from now.
This is, again, I guess either of you could go for it. Alan, perhaps you can respond first. We hear many guests, this is from Alan, and he's in Salt Lake City, and he says, we hear many guests on the show talk about how hard it is to get an academic payload launched. They can't find rides. Often a student who worked on a project will graduate, and his project has still not flown because of the shortage of rides. Does this alleviate that problem?
Well, it's going to go a long way to, absolutely. In fact, because these are commercial firms driven by profit motive, they're thinking very hard about how to simplify the entire process of getting your gear or yourself into space. So one of the things that I know a number of the suborbital firms are talking about is the ability to get an order for somebody to place a request and to be able to fly that experiment or that individual in the same academic semester. So a class could, in January, choose an experiment, and if they can build it, it ought to be able to fly by later in the semester, say in April or May, so the students can get the data during the course. And I think that's going to be really exciting. And by the way, on these vehicles, even at the outset when the prices are probably their highest, we're talking about something like $1,000 a pound as a metric. So for shoebox-sized experiments, any high school that wants to run a car wash or have a big bake sale or find another way to raise, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 ought to be able to do a space experiment. And that's just unprecedented in terms of the educational opportunity for students around this country and in the other 190-something countries on Earth.
Here's my question for you, and then we ought to take a break. And I guess, Alan, because you're a consultant to these companies, maybe this is a good one for you. I have personally made the effort to fly the ashes of my mom and my dogs to space, both orbital and suborbital. And not mentioning any names, but my suborbital efforts have been successful 1 out of 3 times. And another attempt is being made, but they come back down, obviously. So I'm assuming the reliability on these vehicles is going to be a lot better than on a more traditional launch vehicle. And number two, if I gave a little test tube or a canister of ashes to somebody going up there and said, here's $500, take my dog or my mom, you know, to space and bring it back, that's not an issue. And that would just be between me and the passenger doing that. Is there any way they could eject them out of the vehicle then and, you know, let them do whatever they're going to do and eventually come back to Earth? Or would it have to be contained? I'm looking for a sort of and maybe more reliable way of doing a burial.
I hear you, David. Let me break down. I think you asked me 3 questions, and I'm going to answer them in order. The first thing is it going to be reliable? Well, I'll tell you that these firms will fail. There will be no suborbital industry if they're not very, very safe. I don't think people would get on them if there were accidents 1% of the time. They need to be safe as the early airlines. And Burt Rutan, who's probably the best-known name in the design and building of these kind of vehicles, has spoken about that extensively. I know that the suborbital vehicle providers are looking at safety criteria that are factors of 10 and 100 and 1,000 times safer than space flight, for example, on the shuttle and other orbital systems.
Or a rocket launched out of New Mexico that may end up back in the desert.
That's right. So 90%, 95%, 99% success records are not good enough if you're going to fly tourists and educators and scientists. It has to be vastly better than that. Second, could you pay your neighbor or just some random person you know with a ticket to fly something for you? Yes, you could, but whatever you give them, I'm quite certain will have to go through a safety review before it flies, to make sure that, again, it doesn't harm anybody in the cabin or harm the vehicle. So in the case of a little can of ashes, I'm sure it would pass that review if it's well sealed up. But if you dreamed up your own experiment and it involved hydrochloric acid, it might not be safe enough to have in that cabin. Or it might, just depending, but it's going to have to go through that safety review.
Okay. And then if I wanted to eject the ashes out there to burn up in the atmosphere or whatever, that's a different magnitude.
That's a different matter. There's no way on any of these vehicles to open the hatch and throw something out of the cabin. That would expose the cabin to vacuum conditions, and it would be very bad for everyone on board. However, there are suborbital providers and already in the marketplace who can carry things that can be detached from their vehicle, not by throwing it through a hatch, but by, for example, deploying it from the wing or the rocket body or the capsule body of their vehicle. And so I expect that there'll be a market for things deployed. And if somebody wanted to do burials that way and make a business out of it, again, if you can pay the freight and you're safe to the vehicle and the passengers, I think you're going to find suborbital is a great ticket for you.
It certainly opens up a lot of the market opportunities over what's available now for burials, which, by the way, is a global business. Because when I did it on the one successful flight out of New Mexico, you would not believe the international makeup of the families that were participating in that flight with remains of their family members. I was pretty shocked by that. It is truly a global business, and I think if you had access to a lot more frequent flights and a lot better reliability, you'd probably have a lot more participants in that process.
But, I imagine so.
We'll see. Everybody, we're going to pause and take our first break, and we'll be back with our two guests in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to a special edition of The Space Show. And our two guests today, Dr. John Poyman and Dr. Alan Stern, we're talking about suborbital space flights and research. The toll-free number for those of you who would like to call us instead of using email or chat is 1-866-687-7223. And starting out, different kinds of research. What are some ideas on what could effectively be researched with a suborbital flight? Alan, you want to give a run at that?
Sure. It's very broad. John and I serve on a committee of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation that's been canvassing the different scientific communities. And we found strong interest in John's area, of course, which is microgravity physics and chemistry, understanding fundamental properties of, and behavior of materials in space. In terms of engineering tests before you put something in orbit, there's a lot of interest in that. In hypersonic aerodynamics, a lot of interest. In space life sciences, there's a tremendous interest because we're going to be able to fly so many more people in space and get much bigger databases than ever before. In atmospheric science, there's a lot of interest. In education, for classroom demonstrations, for student experiments, there's a lot of interest. And then there are other areas like astronomy that are, of course, a natural for things done in space, although maybe not quite as good for just brief flights like this. Planetary science, in fact, one of the Blue Origin Pathfinder experiments, one done down at the University of Central Florida by Dr. Josh Caldwell, is a planetary science experiment, understanding what happens on the surfaces of asteroids in very, very low gravity, that are essentially zero gravity, but not quite. And I could go on. There are a number of other fields that are interested, but you know what I think is we probably don't know what the very best research applications are today, any more than people in the late 1970s, just before the dawn of the personal computer, knew what the personal computer would really be used for 20, 30 years later. And so I think as we see people start to use these vehicles out across this decade, all kinds of new applications will pop up, some of which I don't think we could even venture to guess today. And that's, to me, one of the most exciting things about it.
If we look at the commercial side of this and get away from some of the scientific research that you've been talking about, just a typical everyday commercial company, Federal Express or UPS or somebody, is there anything that they could do as an experiment that would be applicable to their business? Or maybe it's not a Federal Express, but maybe it's Marriott Hotel Chain or something. I mean, I'm just trying to think if there's something commercial that they can do that's not scientific or engineering-oriented.
Well, I think you'd have to ask the firms. I don't know that a hotel chain would have a research experiment for spaceflight, but I certainly think that semiconductor manufacturers, R&D firms, pharmaceutical manufacturers, even airplane and rocket firms would be a natural for this kind of thing, where the space environment is part of what they need to understand better or they can exploit in the case of microgravity. John, you have some other ideas?
Well, there's one is to use the microgravity environment as a sort of a laboratory platform to answer fundamental questions. The other is to try to understand, say, fluid management in weightlessness. Say, for example, work that Steve Collicott does in studying propellant management on satellites. So there's a big market, I think, a big potential market there for firms who are doing who are using space already. Telecommunications firms with their satellites need to better understand how to handle their material in that environment and be able to do it on a fast turnaround basis.
I'd like to see, maybe it's too premature, but down the road, I'd like to see just your sort of everyday New York Stock Exchange or over-the-counter company say, hey, there's really something I can do here that benefits my company or new product design. I could see Toyota doing something, given that they've turned to NASA to try to see if cosmic rays affect their accelerator problem. Maybe putting some components into space might be applicable to how they program their car computers. I could envision something like that happening.
And that's very innovative. I like that kind of thinking. And I think there'll be more and more of it once people start to see the vehicles flying a lot and researchers getting good results.
The other thing I could see is a watch company sending their watch up and saying tested to 63 miles or, you know, whatever it is, in the vacuum of space or something like that.
I agree. Cameron Swayze used to do. Takes a licking, but keeps on licking.
So I could see a company doing something to have a promotion out of what they did.
I've been involved in the 90s with, say, interacting with scientists at 3M who had done commercial space flight, given opportunities on the space shuttle. And the simple problem is the time frame for normal NASA flights in the past was just far exceeded, I think, the half-life of an average vice president at a big firm. So the people who were trying to develop these things, it was just going to be such a far-range process that it was beyond the business cycle. If there's a chance for a firm to build and fly in several months, I think we'll see more firms that could be examining this as a possibility.
And I think when you couple that with much lower costs, instead of millions and tens of millions, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is within the range of a lot of industrial R&D budgets. It's the size of a single investigator grant at a lot of research agencies. This is, I really like to make the analogy that this is the equivalent of spaceflight going from mainframes to personal computing, and hold on to your hat, because baby, this thing's gonna go up like a rocket for a good reason, both economically and in terms of what the vehicle is itself.
Wayne in Dallas, Texas says, Alan, my understanding is that Blue Origin is not piloted. Do you have anything that you can say about the Blue Origin vehicle, and is it automatic or does it actually have a pilot?
I'm not going to speak specifically to that question, but I can say that the Blue Origin vehicle will fly people, and that you can look on the Blue Origin website. It's public information that it's unlike, for example, the Virgin Galactic vehicle that dropped from another carrier aircraft and sort of looks like an airplane. The Blue Origin vehicle is more like a capsule on top of a rocket.
Okay. What is their website for people who don't know it?
Oh, if you just Google the two words Blue Origin, you'll find it.
Recently, you had this meeting for the Suborbital Research Group, part of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation in Boulder, Colorado. And I believe it was Lori. I was watching the talks on the webcam. Lori Garver was talking about the role that NASA wants to play in supporting or promoting suborbital research. I'm not really clear on it. Can you, either of you, clarify? Is it research dollars that are helping this industry? Is it hardware investment, R&D? What is the NASA role?
Well, I'll speak to that a little bit, and I think John can probably answer as well. What Lori Garver, who's the deputy administrator of NASA, announced here in Boulder in February at the conference you spoke about, is a new program called CRUISER, which is, of course, an acronym for, Commercial Reusable Suborbital Research, is a new NASA effort to exploit the capabilities of these vehicles by investing $75 million over 5 years into suborbital flight missions for research and education. And I don't know the specific details. I know that NASA will be buying rides on these vehicles for equipment, and I know that there's a goal, once the vehicles are proven safe, to later buy seats for experimenters or educators on these vehicles, but that's the more distant goal. I know that there is also interest within the agency of building experiments for these vehicles, not just buying the seats or buying the space, but also funding the research and the research equipment. But the CRUISER program is brand new. It's part of what the president proposes as a new budget line item for NASA beginning this October. And so I think that there's still some design taking place in terms of what the program content will fully be.
Could NASA's involvement, I'm just being the devil's advocate here, get involved to the point where they could try to dictate differences in the vehicles to the point of someone saying government interference? I don't know if I'm asking it right, but I guess I'm trying to find out if government's involvement could skew the damn program.
That's a really complicated question. I think very simply, the simplest way to answer is that a given commercial firm, which is going to derive its revenue from a variety of different sources, from tourism, for example, and from research and education missions, is going to bend to where the market is. And so if the primary customer is a government agency, a single government agency, and that agency wants their vehicle to do something different, they go higher or fly longer or carry more people or have different kinds of windows for research, then I think you'll see the vehicle providers making those accommodations, just like in any business. You know, if more people want pickup trucks, then car companies build more pickup trucks. But, again, it's a commercial enterprise, and so the government doesn't have any way, an agency like NASA or another research agency like NSF, or we could go down the list, doesn't have a way of saying you must build a vehicle this way. It's really the private developer's vehicle. Now, the government might not buy seats or space on a vehicle that doesn't meet its needs, but that's different from having control over the design, direct control over the design.
You know, for me to even talk to you guys from a commercial perspective, even though my background is all business and everything, I'm realizing what a huge shift in thinking is required to even engage you in this discussion, because even asking a question like that, I would never ask if I were interviewing someone from Fed Express, for example. You know, if the government wants to ship normally on you guys exclusively, are you going to modify your planes and trucks, you know, to be government vehicles? FedEx would do what they had to do to woo that contract.
You're right.
Here I'm asking you.
50 years into human spaceflight, and we think of it in a very odd way. We think of it as only an enterprise of government.
Absolutely.
That's enough change.
And I'm noticing that I'm even doing that and talking to you. So for the two of you, how did you had to probably make the shift in how you think about and see things too. I mean, or was this just a natural shift for you to start thinking commercial rather than government kind of projects, you know, the good old business?
Well, I could say myself is dealing with this is so refreshing compared to just the simple involvement I had with the International Space Station. First, we spent years working through a first proposal and developing a plan for an experiment on the space station. And because it was going to be in a manned environment, the safety requirements were very, 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 very high. But the experiment had to be automated because there wasn't crew time. We went through this whole process and passed reviews, and then it was canceled after several years. Then we went to the opportunity to do the zero upmass experiment, that miscible fluids in microgravity, a very, very simple experiment involving squirting honey into water in a urine collection syringe. And I exchanged almost 1,000 emails discussing all the aspects of doing what was basically a trivial experiment an astronaut did in a morning with just some spare parts. So the level of bureaucracy that really impeded the progress. Now it's been so refreshing dealing with Blue and with a scientist of Allen's caliber to help them in dealing with the scientific community, that we're doing something on such a shorter time frame and dealing with people who are extremely responsive and not through layers of bureaucracy. So it's a much more, it's a very pleasant way to deal with things. It's not a change of mindset. It's just, in my opinion, the way things should be done.
Alan, what was your transition to thinking commercial like?
Refreshing, as John's. I have put a lot of my time since leaving NASA headquarters into this dawning era of commercial spaceflight, and a lot of that concentrating on suborbital from a variety of different aspects. And I am finding it refreshing and exciting and really, I hope, the wave of the future. And that's not to say that the things that we're doing on space station and with human exploration getting beyond low Earth orbit aren't important. I'm one of the biggest supporters in the world of that. So I look at this as a new kind of space flight to go shoulder to shoulder, a new kind of application that's going to really revolutionize the way we think about people flying in space. But it won't supplant the things that we do primarily through NASA in this country on station and field.
Todd is in Denver, and Todd wants to know if you're planning to fly internationally or international projects, what is the role of ITAR in your planning and your ability to go commercial?
I'll take a first crack at that, I guess, unless you want to, John.
No, go ahead. You know more about than I.
Yeah, so I'll interpret the you as meaning you, the industry, and
correct,
as opposed to myself personally. I know that some of the firms plan to have overseas launch bases. Virgin Galactic, for example, has signed agreements. I don't know how firm they are, but you know, they've been in the press about, for example, flying up at polar launch bases in Sweden, where they could fly tourists into the aurora or researchers into the auroral regions. They've talked about bases in other places where they're particularly scenic places to fly from and see the Earth, out over the Caribbean or in the Middle East. The list goes on, over in Indonesia. And so the questioner asks a good one about ITAR. I'm no expert in this. Clearly will be some between ITAR and overseas basing, or even the flying non-U.S., non-domestic experiments or experimenters on U.S. vehicles. But to some extent, the analogy is the same as when a Boeing, for example, builds an airliner and then ships it overseas to a foreign place to fly out of. While there's a regulatory environment when you go through all the hoops at the end of that day and all the paperwork signed off, it's completely permissible. And I think we'll see something similar as human suborbital spaceflight goes from something that's novel to something that's entirely routine. And I expect it to be a thing a lot like early aviation, where it proliferates and we'll see bases and vehicles all around the world flying on so frequent a basis that we won't even remember the number of flights, much less when one is taking off.
Any comments from you on that, John?
Well, I just know that there are issues that can involve investigators, and I think the companies are learning how to make it as easy as possible for investigators, because once ITAR comes up, it's a huge hassle for universities to deal with. And LSU was willing to help us with that, but companies are just learning, again, how to comply with regulations and still make it possible for investigations to proceed. It was the same issue that came up with NASA when you had to deal with export controls and stuff. So it's certainly doable, and I think just once everyone gets experience with it, it'll be as seamless as aviation is now.
Would either of you fly and go up on a suborbital ride?
I plan to fly a lot.
You do plan to fly a lot. And what about you, John?
I'd be willing to. And no one's offered me a ride yet, so I don't have to face the problem right yet. But I've done a lot of flying on the KC-135 and look forward to do more, and I certainly would be open to the opportunity.
And David, let me just add that my firm, the Southwest Research Institute, is been public about this. We're trying to get out front. We think this is going to be very, very powerful as a research tool. And so we've already put in place a program to begin to fly our own researchers on these vehicles just as soon as they're up and operational and ready for commercial service, not relying on government dollars, but using internal funds to do that. I'm in charge of that program, and we're very, very excited about it, and already begun training myself, Dan Durda, and Kathy Olkin for early flights doing research.
What does your training consist of?
Well, there's some classroom. There's some experiment development, but the most interesting parts are the kinds of things we've done. Durda and I went off in January to NASTAR, in Philadelphia, and took the centrifuge and altitude chamber aviation physiology, spaceflight aviation physiology course, along with 10 other scientists. And then we just went down last month in March to the Cape and flew flights on F-104 starfighters that can basically rocket off the runway at 6 Gs and take you to 25,000 feet in a matter of a couple dozen seconds, and then top it with a zero-G parabola on something that feels a lot like an abbreviated version of a suborbital ascent profile. And we bought flights on zero-G from zero-G Corp to begin to get more zero-G time, although we've all flown in zero-G before on NASA aircraft. We feel like we're a little bit rusty and we should go back and get primed up before our first space flights. I think those are the highlights.
Do you have any problem with the enhanced gravity or space sickness or anything like that, or are you guys pretty immune to it?
The only problem I have is I can't get enough of it.
You're lucky. I can't imagine what would happen to me even in a centrifuge.
I bet you'd be fine. I have to tell you, I was surprised at how easy the challenge was to fly the centrifuge at the 3Gs, 4Gs, even 5Gs. I'll admit that at 6Gs it's more challenging, and flying the Starfighter at 6Gs and tight turns is challenging, but I'm no spring chicken, and if I can do it, you can do it.
Well, I'm not a fan of roller coasters. I bet you like roller coasters.
No, I hate roller coasters.
Really?
I love space flight.
A lot of the vehicles have different acceleration and reentry, G-force and other profiles. So does that kind of enter into what vehicle the experimenter would want? Do you care about how much G-force or what you're going to subject your experiment to?
John?
Yes. I mean, if it's extremely important to have a longer duration, it depends. Are you interested in the weightlessness? Then trying to find a craft that's going to give you the longest period of weightlessness with the least perturbations. If you're interested in the atmospheric research, the actual acceleration profile may be irrelevant. It probably will be. What's important is the access to the upper atmosphere.
And then when you're coming back, if some of them pull, you know, more Gs coming back, is that relevant, or does it just really depend on what the research was all about?
Well, it's irrelevant, say, how you design the experiment to be able to withstand that. And whether you're trying to, say, for example, retrieve a sample, or in the case of our experiments, all we need are the results of the video. That's all we require from it. There's no sampler required. So in every case, it's much easier. It'll be certainly an issue for, say, certain life science experiments to understand what the reentry profile is, whether your materials or your specimens can withstand it, or from, say, material science, if you're preparing a sample in weightlessness, is it going to be destroyed by the reentry? So it really does depend on the exact type of science you're doing.
Listeners, I'm getting more emails from you, but again, the toll-free number, if you want to use it, 1-866-687-7223. And Larry in Tucson says, Alan, I know this is not on the subject of suborbital research, but can you give us a quick update on New Horizons?
Sure, happy to. My favorite space mission. New Horizons is, of course, NASA's mission on its way to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, and I'm the principal investigator of that mission. New Horizons is in perfect health, on course. The spacecraft is, as we speak, traversing the region between Saturn and Uranus. We're about 17 times as far from the Sun as the Earth is. Most of the way between Saturn and Uranus will cross the orbit of Uranus early next year. Everything on board the spacecraft is working. We just finished the detailed testing of our close flyby sequence for Pluto, which is still 5 years off, but we have a small team, and so we have to do things early to have them all ready. Spacecraft's today hibernating. It's been hibernating as it does much of the year since January. But we'll be waking it up next month on May 25th for about 2 months of systems testing, some software maintenance, a course correction, very small, about a mile per hour, and some crew science. So thanks for asking.
How long does it take to get a communication to the vehicle now?
Currently it's about 3 hours round trip, so that's an hour and a half in each direction.
What's the temperature where it is?
Well, if you put something like a dinner plate outside the spacecraft, it would cool off to a temperature that's probably only about 70 degrees or 80 degrees Kelvin at the distance that we're currently at. But, of course, our spacecraft is much warmer than that because we have electrical heaters that are run from the spacecraft power supply. And, in fact, inside the spacecraft, it's a little bit warmer than room temperature. It's in the high 70s Fahrenheit.
Really? That I never knew. I guess I never asked that question before or knew about that. So you're heating it. Is that to keep the electronics healthy and everything?
That's right. And, in fact, the electronics dissipate waste heat. And just because we have a good thermal design, that does most of the job. We have heaters on board for specific places, particularly the scientific instruments and star trackers that are hanging outside the main body of the spacecraft and tend to get cold. But by and large, inside the cocoon of the spacecraft, the heat from the computers and the power system from the inertial measurement units, other things like that we call avionics, provide most of what we need to keep warm.
Are you surprised by the fact that there is still energy around Pluto being taken off of being a planet? Because I still have had recent authors on with books, and I've seen specials on TV about taking Pluto off the planet list, and it doesn't seem to die away over time. Does that surprise you?
No, because to the great embarrassment of many planetary scientists and astronomers, and to the chagrin of a lot of people, the International Astronomical Union more than just stubbed its toe. They pretty much threw a pie in their own face in claiming that something that obviously looks like a planet isn't a planet. And as far as I can tell, more and more people are just walking away from that. I think when we get pictures back from Pluto, it's going to be very hard to say with a straight face that that's no planet. After all, this is an object that's 2,500 kilometers in diameter almost. It's got an atmosphere, polar cap, seasons, three moons, probably very active geology, and a host of other characteristics, all of which it shares in common with Earth, Mars, Venus, and you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And this is a planet by every measure, except the screwy egghead measure of what else it's next to that the IAU has come up with.
Do you think they'll reverse that position?
You know, I've lost all faith in the IAU, but I don't think it matters because the IAU has no police force and scientists aren't required to follow proclamations. You probably don't know this. Maybe very few of your listeners do. About 20 years ago, the IAU came up with a very, very complicated definition of what north means in space. It's so complicated and so flawed because, for those of you who are technical, it violates the right-hand rule of angular momentum in 50% of the cases that most planetary scientists don't use it. It's just screwy. So the IAU has a history of this kind of thing, and they've just become ignored.
You're talking about north, the direction north in space?
Right.
I'll have to Google that.
You think it's easy, but the IAU made it hard and came up with a very flawed definition that's not only hard to understand, it's unworkable because it violates the basic concept of cross products and the right-hand rule.
Interesting. You have an LRO mission too, right?
Well, I play a bit role in the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. We have an instrument on board that is called LAMP, which is studying the lunar surface and lunar atmosphere.
And that's healthy and working?
It's going just great, along with the rest of the LRO mission, orbiting the moon every 2 hours as we speak.
And then you mentioned to me during the break the Rosetta mission, right?
Right. I have a bit role in that as well. Rosetta is a comet orbiter, the first ever spacecraft on its way to orbit and study a comet in detail. It's a joint project of the European Space Agency and NASA. And again, I'm responsible for one of the instruments that we developed. It's a U.S. instrument called ALICE. It's an ultraviolet spectrometer, which will be studying the surface and the atmosphere of the comet that we're headed towards. When we get there, we're not there yet. It's going to be another 4 years. But on the way, we have a flyby of an enormous asteroid, 100 kilometers across. It's coming this year on July 10th, and we're really looking forward to that.
This is Dick, and Dick is in San Antonio, Texas. He says, John, I'm curious to know the lead time at your university, or probably most universities, to develop, fund, and then fly a project like you're talking about doing with Blue Origin. And have you already started on a sequel or another project after your current demonstration flight project is completed?
Well, we have not. I'll answer the last question first. We have not developed on a sequel, but our hope is that the hardware will be able to learn from it and design future and then be seeking further opportunities. This is a unique opportunity to have this demonstration flight where we're given the flight opportunity for free and we provide the hardware. We're doing all of this for under $10,000 in about a year and a half with undergraduates and professors, and say most of the development is done at William Jewell College, which is an excellent liberal arts college. So this really illustrates the opportunity that we can do with the suborbital, the kind of research we can do with just everything is off the shelf. We're building a few custom-made brackets or something. All the hardware is straight off the shelf, some things from Lowe's, other things just standard optics companies, nothing esoteric. And that's because we're doing, you know, with this commercial firm that's letting us do it this way. So we're doing it in a nice short period of time for low cost.
So start to flying is maybe 18 months or shorter?
I'm thinking, Alan, is that something we know we can say?
Well, what we can say is that John, we announced that the three experimenters were selected. We announced that last fall.
Right.
And if you look on Blue's website, what you'll see is that we expect to fly those experiments next year.
Right.
And you think human flight will start around 2012?
Well, certainly that's what Virgin Galactic and X-Corps are advertising. I can't talk to you about Blue's plans in any more depth than what's on the website. And that points to human flight in the 2012-ish era as well. But all these vehicles, all of them, whether you talk to Mastin or X-Corps, Armadillo, Blue, whoever, will tell you that safety comes first. And for everybody, schedule is second to getting it right. And so I think that we'll see a very measured approach to test flights across the industry. And if 2011 becomes 2012 or 12 becomes 13, I think everybody appreciates that getting it right is more important than getting it first.
By the way, listeners, the Blue website is www.blueorigin.com. Real easy to remember. Barbara in Portland, Oregon, says, do you know if there will be any environmental requirements for any of the experiments, or would the experiment have to be something that would go outside the vehicle to be subject to any environmental regulations?
Oh, you mean, she probably means environmental, like EPA.
I think so, yeah, something like that.
Right. Certainly if the vehicle puts anything in the atmosphere, for example, there are regulatory requirements that relate to that. But inside the cabin, if they're not directly interfacing the environment, I'm not thinking of anything offhand, but I don't claim to be an expert in that. So experimenters probably have to do their own research to really find out if they have to meet some needs or not from a regulatory standpoint.
John, did you have to meet any regulatory EPA
no.
needs or nothing like that?
No, if you consider a typical chemistry lab, we have exhaust hoods, and as long, we're putting trace amounts of materials. I mean, there are things that are regulated, but I would find it hard to believe there has to be an environmental impact statement unless there was something special. But as I say, I'm not an expert in atmospheric science. I think there's an issue that none of your listeners have asked about is FAA, and Alan, you know, we've had presentations on this, and I only know things secondhand, and I'm hoping you remember more about how the FAA, there's a special office even dealing with this, because that's the one area that where there is direct regulatory issues relating to suborbital, and I wonder if you could, I think the listeners would like to hear what the FAA is going to do, or how they treat suborbital flights.
Sure. The Federal Aviation Administration, of course, is responsible for airspace, and that's how, from a regulatory standpoint, they get involved. They've been involved also for years in the licensing of commercial space flights. Most of people aren't aware of that. They're not even aware that there are commercial space flights until you say, well, what about all those communication satellites that are up there? There are hundreds in geosynchronous orbit. And then there are commercial land remote sensing satellites and others. And then people go, oh, yeah, of course, there is already a commercial spaceflight industry. Well, it's the FAA that licenses those launches and that is responsible, in the case of suborbital, for regulating the safety environment, both for participants in the spaceflight and for bystanders, to make sure that people who are on the ground, either around a spaceflight or under it, aren't being subject to any particular danger. And so the FAA's role is primarily with regard to setting standards and a regulatory environment for what it means to be a commercial versus an experimental vehicle, how those vehicles get permitted, how they and their flight crews are licensed, and what requirements they have to be safe, etc. I think that that covers it. But David, if there's more you want to know, or John, I'll try and field it.
I think it'll just, in a way, it'll unfold because, as you said earlier, we probably don't have a clue what all these experiments and what the demands are going to be, because who knows what businesses and entrepreneurs are going to create and have an idea for. So it's almost watch it develop as it develops.
I think that's right. One of the most heartening things I've seen in my couple years now working with commercial spaceflight is the real lean forward, positive, can do, let's go make it happen and figure out how to make it happen safe attitude that the Federal Aviation Administration has. That effort's currently led by George Neal, who's the associate administrator at FAA responsible for space activities. He's got a great staff, and they are unsung heroes in the development of commercial space.
Michael in Santa Barbara, California says, I'm curious if launch location would factor into your experiment design. Is space the same no matter where you launch from, or would there be a difference in the space launch, say, from New Mexico versus Wallops if you're going to the same altitude?
I can answer in terms of weightlessness, it doesn't matter. That only matters on the actual trajectory of the flight. But
from the standpoint of the very, very high upper atmosphere and the ionosphere, things that they're up there at those altitudes that are part of the natural environment, there are differences. And although you don't have to design your experiment very differently to fly out of Wallops or out of White Sands, in fact, you really wouldn't have to make any changes at all. You might be making changes for certain types of experiments if they were going to fly up in the polar regions where there's more radiation, for example.
Would the radiation bother or affect a suborbital project where it's only up there for a couple of minutes?
Well, it could, particularly depending upon what the space weather environment is, what the sun is doing, and what the aurora are doing. And, in fact, that could be a safety of flight issue, just like you would never fly an airplane intentionally into a lightning storm. There are auroral conditions that you wouldn't want to fly the spacecraft into. That's pretty easy to deal with. The same way we don't fly into lightning, we just make sure that we don't fly in those places at those times. But it is something you have to think about.
Well, they get hit by lightning all the time. But...
Right, but you wouldn't intentionally fly it there.
Any more than you'd fly it into a flock of birds, right?
There you go.
Did you, by the way, see the pictures of the aurora and lightning from the space station the other day doing a flip-flop turn that's going around the Internet?
You know, I have not, but I'm going to Google it right now.
Are there actual videos?
No, it's a string. What I received may have at one time been a video, but it's you scroll down the page and there's like 20 different snapshots of the station doing this maneuver, and you see the aurora in the background, and it's actually pretty cool. And I wish I were up there seeing it firsthand, that's for sure. I may have saved it. If I saved it, I'll send it to you guys after the show.
Thank you. Oh, that'd be great.
But you know, there's some really gorgeous sights to be held. And we're coming toward the end of the show, but let me ask you about that. The view from most of the suborbital flights, what do you think? I mean, it's not going to be the same as what I'm talking about from the space station, obviously, but any ideas? I mean, can you extrapolate and tell us what the view you think will be like?
Sure. First of all, the sky is entirely black from suborbital altitudes. You can see the curvature of the Earth, the thin blue crescent of the atmosphere. If you go on YouTube or other places on the web, you can see video made from suborbital flights, both the XPRIZE flights that Spaceship One made, as well as even X-15 videos and from unmanned sounding rockets. And you'll see it's lower than a space station altitude, but in terms of the view, it's very, very similar. You know, if the Earth were the size of a basketball, the space station only orbits about an inch above that basketball in that scale model. These suborbital flights take place at sort of a half inch or a third of an inch, but way above the atmosphere. So you look down on your part of the world, and it'll be your part of a planet. It'll be a spaceflight experience.
You wouldn't be able to see coast to coast from the United States, right?
Not all the way. If you were in the middle of the United States, like in Kansas City, and launched a suborbital mission to 140 kilometers, you would not quite see the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. But if you launch from Mojave, California, for example, where Spaceship Two is now testing, they could see all up and down the coast at apogee altitudes. That vehicle can see from Baja all the way north up into Washington State. So it's a pretty magnificent view.
Absolutely. As we move toward the end of the program today, do you folks want to give out email contact for listeners who will hear this on archives and the podcast, or should they go through me if they have follow-up questions or comments?
Well, for me, they just go to poimen.com and get information on our past scientific investigations in weightlessness and our current interest. And also they can get links to the world's largest collection of pocket protectors. I can't help but give a plug for that.
What is a pocket protector, by the way?
Well, the old-fashioned pocket protectors you put in your pocket.
Oh, with the pens and ink, the things in it?
Right. I have 961 on my website, and I'm always looking for people to donate if they'd like to have theirs memorialized in the world's largest online museum.
How did you end up collecting pocket protectors?
I just got one from the American Chemical Society several years ago, and thought it was cool that they still were made, and started getting interested in it, and I've just been collecting them ever since.
Outstanding. Listeners, check that one out. Alan, what about contacting you?
Well, first of all, I can't top John.
I don't think anybody can.
I have one pocket protector, and I guess you can Google me on the web and find my website and things like that, and lots of people, you know, of course, are Facebook friends, and I want to say hi to my friends in Streeter, Illinois, who I know are listening, and beyond that, I don't type very fast, so I hope I don't get thousands of emails, because it's hard to respond to them all.
No, you only get that when you're working on a government project, as John explained earlier.
That's right.
That's when you get the thousands of emails. Any concluding comments, or as I like to say, pearls of wisdom from you both? John, you want to go first?
Well, this is, I think, to any young people listening, that this is going to be a great opportunity in the future where you'll be able to design experiments and be able to get really involved in space research. And so look for universities that are going to be offering that, or the opportunity for high schools to get involved, and stay tuned. It's going to be an exciting era coming ahead.
By the way, you said something interesting that I just thought of that I should ask you about for an extra minute. You mentioned that this William Jewell College is a liberal arts college, yet they're involved in making hardware for a space mission. How does that happen?
Well, because it's a very talented professor, Pat Bunton, and excellent students, and they're doing everything as off-the-shelf hardware. So it's, you know, it's that's the kind of environment that we're going to be able to work in, where we don't need to have incredibly expensive custom-made machinery. These are all off-the-shelf components.
So liberal arts, we're talking about literature, government, history?
Well, these are physics majors.
Okay.
But it's not a school with a graduate program. These are undergraduates who are getting an undergraduate degree in Liberty, Missouri, and they're very talented students. I've had the pleasure to visit many times, and top-notch students who are, as they say, building real hardware that's going to fly on a real experiment. And I think that's just a wonderful opportunity for them.
Really cool. Alan, any pearls of wisdom that you have for us?
Well, I don't know about pearls of wisdom, but I do want to say that I echo what John said. This is going to be really exciting, and I think it's just going to get better and better as we move through the teens and the 20s. In my view, it's way too late. In fact, I don't know why we didn't get started in suborbital in the 70s or 80s, because the technology was there to do it. But this is the opening of spaceflight to the people. And I am really looking forward to it, not just as a researcher, but just as a human being, to see to see this open up in a way that's what we've always considered to be science fiction coming down to Earth at the same time that it's going up into space. It's going to be really amazing to see people's faces and to hear their experiences. I expect that 15 and 20 years from now, we should be thinking about the Boy Scout merit badges and student science fair projects done in space. This is really going to revolutionize everything about the way people think about space flight, and I can't wait.
Neither can I, and we're all looking forward to it and your updates on these projects and your missions and what you're doing. So I'm sure we'll stay in touch as the months and the projects unfold. So let me thank you both for being with us on this special space show program. I look forward to talking to you both again down the road.
Thank you.
And
thanks, David.
Okay, and have a great weekend. And listeners, that's it. Our next space show will be on Monday. So this is replacing our Sunday show this week. So don't tune in tomorrow thinking there's another show. And, again, special thanks to Dr. Alan Stern and Dr. John Poyman. And back again Monday. Goodbye, everyone.